eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we diet, is a favourite saying of my mother-in-law. I obviously can't really go around saying that very much with my figure. But it's a play, of course, on the more serious message, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And this refrain can be heard again and again throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. The teacher in Ecclesiastes seems obsessed with death in this book, his autobiography. In chapter 1, the teacher describes with melancholy in verse 4 that generations come and generations go. In the section that follows today's reading, the teacher exclaims that death renders both wisdom and folly meaningless because verse 16 of chapter 2, like the fool, the wise too must die. We also have a reference to the brevity of life in our passage this lunchtime about the meaninglessness of pleasure. Read with me the end of verse 3. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. Our teacher knows that man is a finite being limited by time and space. In this way, he is distinct from God. He is mortal while God is immortal. Man is also distinct from all other animals. He is, after all, the only creature who is aware of his limits. He knows that he will die and that his near ones, those he loves, will also die. Now, in the final book of Philip Pullman's Dark Materials trilogy, Lyra, the protagonist, descends to the underworld in order to talk to Roger, her former best friend. And she finds there a village of people waiting to be ferried by the ancient boatman Charon across the river, Acheron, to the land of the dead. And as she walks amongst these people, she notices an old lady lying on a bed on her own under a duvet. Let me read what happens next. As Lyra looked at her, she had a shock. The blanket stirred, and a very thin arm emerged in a black sleeve. And then another face, a man so ancient it was almost a skeleton. In fact, he looked more like the skeleton in the picture than like a living human being. What we have here is the personification of death. It's revealed that all humans have their own private death nearby who follows them all their lives. It's a dark, shadowy character who stays out of sight throughout life, but never is far off. So whenever you turn your head, your death dodges behind you. Whenever you look, they hide. And they can hide in a teacup, or a dewdrop, or even in a breath of wind. Only finally showing up in your final dying days as death approaches. And it's this reality of death that means we cannot easily stop ourselves thinking about it. It's a state of affairs which is disturbing and absurd, almost unimaginable. And it's a state of affairs that prompts the deepest reflection, and it prompted the author of Ecclesiastes to write these philosophical reflections that conclude in verse 11 with, everything is meaningless, or at the very least, everything is temporary. Now, it was Socrates, that great philosopher of Athens, who declared, to live the unexamined life isn't worth living. And our teacher, here in Ecclesiastes, would agree with that injunction. And this week, we are here to consider the examination of the place of pleasure during the few days of our lives. So let us notice first, pleasure's answer to death. Now, salvation is defined in any dictionary as the condition of being saved, of escaping a great danger or misfortune. It's the human plight to be in search of meaning and belonging. We all long, don't we, to be understood, to be loved, not to be alone, not to be separated from our loved ones. In short, not to die, and not to have them die on us. It's unsurprising then that all people long for salvation from that great danger of death. Each one of us desires immortality. It's not only Christianity and other religions which promise salvation. Philosophy also does. But how? Luke Ferrier, in A Brief History of Thought, argues that if religions can be defined as doctrines of salvation, the great philosophies can be defined as doctrines of salvation, but without the help of a God. Ferrier then goes on to explain what he understands this salvation to involve by quoting a Greek philosopher. Epicurus prescribed philosophy as medicine for the soul because its ultimate aim is to make us aware that death is not to be feared. Philosophy then provides salvation from the fear of death. And we encounter the same hope in the famous Renaissance thinker Montaigne's famous adage, "To philosophize is to learn how to die." Stoicism, one of the ancient Greek philosophical schools, went so far as to reduce all of the philosophical questions to a single issue, the fear of death. The other well-known school of thought, Epicureanism, argued that the fear of death can be best overcome by the help of pleasure. Epicurus considered pleasure to be the greatest good. He believed that by enjoying life's pleasures in a modest way, one can gain knowledge of the workings of the world and the limits of one's desires. And this led, he believed, to one attaining a state of tranquility and freedom from fear of death, that ultimately led to a state of happiness in this life. In this passage before us, we find the teacher describing his own attempt to find meaning in pleasure. He announces there in verse 1 that he will explore the real value of pleasure. You'll notice first, in verse 3, he begins with the most infamous pleasure, alcohol. And he begins by cheering himself with wine. Now, he will not have been the first young person or indeed older person who has set out for a night on the town to drink him or herself silly in the name of pleasure seeking. It appears, however, that he limited his consumption so that his mind was still bright enough to learn from the experiment. He then shifts from the purely sensual and self-centered pleasure of alcohol to the more grandiose achievements of constructing large works. In verses 4 through 6, you'll notice, he built gardens and parks with every kind of fruit. He also constructed irrigation pools to provide the necessary water for their cultivation and growth. And commentators have noted that the language in these verses actually corresponds to God's creation in the Garden of Eden. What appears to be happening here is that the teacher has built his own paradise, but sadly, that wasn't sufficient. The teacher's large property holdings required many servants, and in verse 7 we see he had many. He also has many herds and flocks, and you can understand, can't you, why he is often associated with the teacher, with Solomon, because of his great wealth. Our teacher rounds off his description of the sensual pleasures by describing his acquirement of silver and gold and also a choir to regale him in verse 8. He then tells of his sexual explorations. He literally lived out his sexual fantasies. In verse 10, we read, "He denied himself nothing his eyes desired." You see, here is a man who practiced pleasure as a lifestyle for a season. Now you'll remember that Epicurus believed that by enjoying life's pleasures in a modest way, one can gain knowledge of the workings of the world and come to understand the limits of one's desire. Now I believe we have reason here to conclude, even from the teacher's modest use of alcohol, that he approached pleasure in a modest way. Not so much a pursuit of pleasure in that kind of reckless, escapist way, more a testing if pleasure could bring meaning. I think we can also safely assume that the teacher gained the knowledge of the workings of the world and maybe came to understand the limits of desire. But did his experimentation lead to a state of tranquility and freedom from fear of death. Did his seeking after pleasure lead to a state of happiness in this life? Did it bring salvation from the fear of death? Well, he may well have enjoyed a temporary state of tranquility, a temporary relief from the fear of death, but it would appear from verse 11 that any freedom from anxiety soon passed. Before long, he is bemoaning the meaninglessness of everything, the meaninglessness of pleasure, by which I would suggest he means the limitation of what pleasure can accomplish. It's interesting that in verse 2, the teacher even suggests that the best that pleasure can achieve is laughter, which at best is a superficial joy. Now, it's true that laughter can be a soothing balm in the face of the fear of death, but when the laughter stills, the looming dark reality remains. It's important to understand that the teacher is not suggesting that wine, relationships and song, as well as architecture and gardening, are all necessarily wrong in themselves, or indeed that they do not bring pleasure. It's just that they do not alleviate, ultimately, the fear of death. Some would say the fear of death is nothing when faced with what awaits at the other side of death. So let's notice, secondly, the gospel's answer to death. Now, Ecclesiastes is never quoted in the New Testament, but there is an allusion to the message in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 8, verses 18 to 21. And let me read those few verses to you. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. And this passage here in Romans speaks of life under the sun, apart from God. It speaks of creation enduring frustration or meaninglessness as a result of the curse of the fall. Matthiotes, translated frustration, is the word used in the Septuagint, which of course is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, to translate the Hebrew word for meaninglessness. But this passage in Romans also speaks of liberation from death and decay of the curse. It speaks of freedom. It speaks of hope. Now, we may find the thoughts of the teacher depressing, but he presents a true assessment of the world apart from the light of God's redeeming love. He sounds to me very modern because he so vividly captures the despair of the world without God, even if our colleagues at work might not agree. In verse 11 we read, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." But what have you achieved with your hands? What have you achieved with your life? Now, I'm sure that at one level this is far from meaningless in your career alone. I'm sure that it has brought many of you a sense of purpose and achievement. It is, after all, a biblical mandate, isn't it, to work. I'm sure that you have enjoyed many of the pleasures tested by the teacher. Yet do you not periodically find yourself standing on the precipice of life, echoing something of the sentiments of verse 11? I certainly do. Until I remember the gospel's answer to death. You see, in the gospel we find not only an answer to the fear of death, but to death itself. We not only find salvation from the fear of death, but we find immortality. We see that Jesus Christ is the one who redeems us from the meaninglessness under which the teachers suffered. Jesus redeemed us from the teacher's meaningless world by subjecting himself to it. Hanging on the cross, Jesus experienced the frustration of this world under curse in a way that the teacher could not even possibly have imagined. For Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. And as a result, you can experience deep pleasure in those areas where the teacher only ultimately found dissatisfaction. Christ restored meaning to wine, to relationships, to music, to architecture, to gardening. See, after all, by facing death, Jesus conquered the biggest fear facing the teacher. He showed that for all believers, death is not the end of all meaning, but the entrance into the very presence of God. Amen.